Session number 1148, Reel 6.
Analyst Marocan, Reel 6. So I said that we had burnt our identity cards 3 months ago upcountry when our brigadier quarter was surrounded, and the brigadier and I and a few other staff officers, he burnt our identity cards, and we haven't had time to obtain fresh ones. This, instead of being taken in a humorous way that I gave the story, was taken quite differently. So he made me sit down with two men carrying Sten guns pointing at me, and he went in search of the CEO. The CEO of the battalion had gone to the brigade headquarters. Now I was sitting there looking at these two men and begging for an officer to come and see me. They said, "Oh no, when officer is here, he'll come and see you." So all in all, I was kept under arrest there for a good part of the day. I think it was about 6 hours I was detained there. Finally, this captain came to me. He said, "No." At one time during the day, he came to me and said, "Would you have some lunch?" By then, I lost my temper. I said, "You can do to your lunch, something to do to your lunch." I said, "I'm not going to eat it. I'll sit there till you get in touch with my battalion." I said, "For heaven's sake, get in touch with my battalion, 2nd 10th Baloo, just behind you. Get in touch." By then, we were attached to the 15th Brigade, because 8th Brigade had practically ceased to exist. So I said, "You ask the 15th Brigade headquarters. They know me. Nothing doing." Finally, towards 4 o'clock in the afternoon, a Bren gun carrier rolled up, and they took me out to the Bren gun carrier, where the CEO was sitting in it, big, fat, burly British officer with lieutenant colonel with spectacles. He looked at me, and I looked at him. I said, "Sir, I've been under arrest here." All he said was, "No, I checked up. You're all right. You can go." And I looked at him. I said, "Sir, I hope you don't have to come to your help in case of an attack, because I shall mislead my battalion. I've been entreated at you." "Did they entreat you?" I said, "Yes." And into the bargain, they told me that they just shot two Chinamen and one South Indian who were being 5th columnists. They took him away right from under my nose and shot them. I heard the bullets being fired. And they told me they've just shot them. So I was by then shaking. I said, "Before you can say Jack Robinson, they'll go and shoot me too?" Anyhow, so I was released from my temporary arrest, and I came back to my battalion. When I arrived at my battalion, by then they had their mudlocking the whole day, and they were speculating as where could I have disappeared to. There were various speculations. I went out to town. I went down to see a girlfriend. I went somewhere for some kind of objectionable activities. But when I told them the story, it brought the roof down. Everybody howled with laughter. "Some of you bloody were right," and that sort of thing. Anyhow, it didn't last too long. On the night of the 7th and 8th, the Japanese guns boomed again, and they opened with everything that could carry an artillery shell on the Australian front towards the Tenga air base on the Bukit Timah Road from the mainland. To illustrate about the shell fire that for about a whole night, started early in the evening and continued the whole night till the morning when it stopped, when the Japanese landed on the short side of the Australian position. It was a complete artillery drum fire, like a drum being beaten the whole time without any pause. So the poor devils, the Australians, couldn't possibly survive that shelling. They were falling backwards slowly. Finally, the Japs attacked, and the fighting started on Bukit Timah Road towards the Singapore main city. Now, we were in this United Plantation. The road used to go towards Nee Soon Cantonment in Singapore Island, which was the barracks and the headquarters of the Hong Kong Singapore Royal Artillery. They were mostly AKEK, anti-aircraft units. And on the 9th morning, the attack took place 7th and 8th night. On the 9th, we were told to get ready. And by the 10th morning, we were told to move to Mandai Road. Now, Mandai Road connected the causeway. From the causeway, the road turned towards Singapore, Bukit Timah Road. Mandai Road connected the Bukit Timah Road and the Nee Soon Cantonment and the Seletar Reservoir. We were told to advance on the Mandai Road. First 13th, usually on the right of the road, we were on the left of the road. Road inclusive, move. So we moved. As we moved along the road, our CO went ahead. First he went to the brigade headquarters, from there he came, he said he's going ahead to recce the road. We were told, according to the information, that the Australians were holding the road towards the Mandai Road, the flank of the Australians fighting on Bukit Timah Road. So we secured in that knowledge, we moved gaily along the road. The CO at one time turned on to me, said, I should move forward and liaise with the Australian troops on the Mandai Road and tell them we are coming behind them. So I kicked my motorcycle into action and went off. As I was going along the road, I saw a platoon of Australians moving up a hill, bare hill, without trees. A platoon, they're moving up, so I stopped my motorbike and they looked back at me and they kept moving and I started following them. When I got near them, I said, well, we are coming on this road, the whole brigade. He said, well, they have lost their battalion. There are jabs between the battalion and them, and they are going to try to locate their battalion. So I said, I asked them if they meant that jabs are all around, on the right and left of the road. They said yes. And then at that very moment, two armored cars came from the front, shooting on both sides of the road. Australian armored cars. So I ran down the hill, picked up my motorbike, and first I followed them. Then they stopped, turned around, and I went past them and found a few miles ahead at the 13-mile stone. I found my CO standing there, ruefully looking at a map and at his crashed station wagon. He had been attacked by a Japanese patrol. He got away by the skin of his tooth, just a map in hand and a driver. So I went to him, reported the matter. There's the Australians are all over the place. So he stood in that place. I said, go and get the battalion up. As we were looking towards the Mandai Road, from the Mandai Road towards the east, there was a feature, 195, and another feature on the left, 225. And he said, well, the CO decided to occupy those two features. As he was thinking of occupying it, Peter Campbell, our second commander, had come forward too. So three of us are standing there looking at, on the feature 195, I saw under a tree turbaned soldiers coming down. And they stopped under the tree, which I couldn't see. Them under the tree, bushy tree. So I grabbed a 2-inch mortar from a man moving up, slapped it down, and I lobbed about 3 or 4 shells into that tree. And then the firing started from all over the place. So the CO ordered Colonel Phil Parker, A Company and B Company, to go and capture feature 195 on the right of the road. And he ordered the C Company and B Company to go and occupy the feature 225. They were going to spread out you know, occupying the space. The two features. As he gave the orders, somebody said, where's the artillery officer? The FOO, the forward observing officer. Field observing officer, forward observing officer, FOO, artillery officer. So I went in search of him. He wasn't anywhere to be found. Finally, I found one and brought him up. But there was no time for giving any artillery covering fire. A company lost the company commander, Alan Coombe. I just saw him a few minutes before he was killed. He tried to take my walking stick. I stabbed him back for him. I said, no, I'll keep it with me. You go. He went up, and I heard that he was shot. Then B company, I told them, you continue with the attack. Go through them. B company commander bent down to in front of me to give a drink to a wounded and give some morphine tablets, and he was shot. So I skipped about, you know, the bullets. And I went up and I told the subedar, I said, you take our command. The subedar of A company, subedar Fateh Khan had taken our command. And here the D company subedar Lal Khan took our command. And I went back and told the CEO on the road. I said, both the companies are held up. Then he told me to go up and call the B company and the C company back too. So I told them to start thinning out. They said, look, Japs are all over the bloody place. How can we attack without artillery fire? So I said, your orders are to withdraw now. That was on the 11th of...
February.
10th or 11th. I think the 10th of February. 11th of February. So we were told to withdraw. So we withdrew along the road. Before that, I had gone to contact the first 13 Frontiers Rifles who were on the right of the road. And I got there to see them, and I met them when they committed themselves into a full-blooded counterattack against the Japanese. Bullets were flying thick, and the CEO thought it was great fun to have me along. He said, come on, you smile, let's go. And I was declining the offer. I said, I'm going back to my battalion. And then he got the very bad news of his very great Viceroy commissioned officer, Subedar Guldin. He was a Malikuddin Khan Afridi who was killed. And Gilbert was given this news, Golly Gilbert, the CEO. And having received the news, I excused myself and went back to my battalion. So fighting there was completely confused the whole day. By the evening, we withdrew. The jolly old first 13 took a position on the right of the road. We took a position on the left of the road at the Salitar Reservoir. Salitar Reservoir is a big reservoir for water supply of Singapore. There we arrived and in the evening, and we went to sleep, and next morning we took up positions. No news for the Australians. Australians were most, as far as we are concerned. They were surrounded, and they were captured. Old battalion. We began to reorganize ourselves immediately. Our A company held the road, the Mandai Road. C and D company went up to the right. The left of the road, around the reservoir, the B company took up position. They were feeling very secure because they had the whole reservoir in front of them. But they could see the road, which was hidden from us, with a feature in the middle. It was a bend in the road. While his left forward platoon and his headquarter company, he could see the road, the other side of the bend. And he reported that the Japanese are collecting the civilians, and there are about 100-odd civilians, Chinese men and women, and they were told to walk ahead. And the Japanese are presumably coming behind them as a human screen. They were going to use them. So this, he reported to me, and I reported to the CEO. I was in the front with the A company position, checking up on the information in the front. No aerial bombing took place, no shelling took place the whole day. Sporadic shelling. But a great deal of shelling was taking place on the right at the naval base, because Japs are attacking the naval base at that time. One of the battalions of the 8th Punjab were on our right on the high ground, and they were completely mauled that day. One of their young captains was with them. He was also young captain called Ali Akbar. He was killed there too. Incidentally, his son served under me as my garrison engineer in mid-50s, later 50s, and then he ended up as a lieutenant general later and retired. So Captain Burhanuddin was commanding this B company, the Chatrali officer that I told you about, and he was teed up. When the civilians went past him, the Japs appeared behind him. He let them have it with his light automatic, light machine guns, which they could get them. They were about 600-700 yards away, and he roasted them. And we were told that he has held them up. The whole day the Japs couldn't move. They were moving up to their left, where they met this 8th Punjab, who came with a great deal of mauling by them. By the late afternoon, he said that tanks coming up. Tanks coming up. And at that time, out of nowhere, a young second lieutenant appeared, a British officer, with three anti-tank guns, the old two-pounder guns. And he sighted them on the road in front of me. And when he heard about the tanks, he said, could we tell the men not to open fire till he has a go at them? And it was the early evening, these three tanks appeared. He let them come around the bend. Burhanuddin kept them busy, lobbing three-inch mortar shells over them. But they came along. As they came along, I was standing with this tank commander, a young second lieutenant, and he took all the three tanks. He placed his guns in an enfilading position. Boom, 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 all three tanks caught fire and disabled. We were dancing with sheer joy. Men were cheering all around us. The Pathans went crazy. And the Pathans were saying, let us go ahead and give him this thing, launch a counterattack. We held them with great difficulty. I went and told the CO, and by just before dark, we got orders to withdraw. Before dark. So we started withdrawing on the main road. There, our battalion was withdrawing. I was waiting on the culverts. Battalion passed through, all passed through. And then I saw other battalions from naval base side coming. One among them was the 3rd Indian Cavalry. Mud is their tanks fighting like infantry. They had no tanks when they came to Malaya. They fought in Mohar and Slim, got very badly mauled and died. So on the 12th evening when we drew, we came to Paya Liba Road in Bidadari. 13th, February, we took positions on Bidadari Paya Liba Road, Singapore Island, just on the outskirts of the town. This Bidadari had a big, extended Muslim graveyard. And our battalion was, well, we were suffered innumerable casualties again. So we got the 2nd 18th Galwal Regiment. They were left about two companies and a headquarter company, and they joined our battalion and made one battalion. So we held the Bidadari graveyard and the Paya Liba Road. That night, on the night of the 13th, 14th, Peter Campbell, our second commander, and I were sleeping in between two graves. He was strangely active in his sartorial activities. Started shaving and cleaning up and washing himself and put on a fresh pair of trousers and a shirt and kept on filling in his haversack various items of his clothing. And strangely happy. And when I went to sleep, I woke up the middle of the night, there was no Peter Campbell. Obviously, he was being evacuated from Singapore as a nucleus of officers to convey to the rest of the world about the debacle in Singapore and Malaya. He, from our battalion, and Richard Dent from the brigade headquarters, he was with us as our brigade major since we left India, and they were both evacuated. Richard Dent was killed at a roadblock in Singapore. Peter Campbell escaped in a boat to Sumatra. They were bombed on the way. He was wounded in the stomach, and his elder brother met him there. He belonged to these workshop companies, the four runners, think of the Rimis. Rimi was later. They were ordinary station workshop companies and the ordinaries. And he saw his brother, and he said, he's going on a ship, so Peter will be picked up on the next ship. And he left him there, to his great regret, for years to come. So Peter was captured by Japanese there, in Sumatra, taken to Sumatra. And he joined later on in the mid, about 1943. I think 44 or 43, he was back with heavy bands of prisoners in the Changi camp among the British. So we were there 14th. And 14, 15 night was very bad for our battalion. Very bad. A, B, and C company, in their positions, in the graveyard in Bidadari. By the morning, with sporadic fighting, all three disappeared. They were surrounded, bit by bit, section by section, platoon by platoon. That, to my mind, after when I studied the case, was that they were badly sighted. Badly sighted in as much as that they could not support each other, which was the basis of defensive, the basic thing of the drill for a defensive position. Whom to blame, I will not mention now. Anyhow, at night, about 2 o'clock in the morning, Peter having disappeared the day before, I got a call from Bertie Lee, commander of the A Company, very sleepy, very fed up. He said, Burhanuddin, the B Company commander, is making his life misery by keep on telling him, telephoning him, that the Japanese are surrounding everybody. So I conveyed the message to the TAC battalion headquarters, to Pop Thistleton Dyer, who from A Company command had become the adjutant by then. So he went up to Ricky. As he went up in the first light, in the firing he was wounded, and he came back, found nobody. Finally, the thing appeared that the A Company was surrounded. Then the Indian 5th Columnists from the Indian Army, Indian National Army, went and told Prem Kumar Saigal, the C Company commander, Bertie Lee, A Company commander wants you. The Company commander front wants you. As he went up, he found Bertie Lee surrounded by Japs. And he kept on showing the men are not fighting. And as he struggled with the Japs killed him. Slashed him with a sword. Then somebody went and told his company, Subedar Charagaram, Captain Saigal wants you forward. Your captain company commander wants you forward. So he marched the company forward. They were all surrounded. By perfidy, by 5th Columnist activities, by lack of will fighting, by lack of will for fighting among the men, and mistaken positions, A Company and C Company disappeared. Phil Parker, our CO, ordered Burhanuddin in the morning, you take 2 platoons and go forward. He protested. He said, look, if I go, you're sending me into a trap. But he was told to go. So he went up and he found himself surrounded. As he was going forward, the Japs were appearing right behind him. From every nook and corner, the ground was very undulated, series of mounds and things like that. So we discovered by the morning that we were left with just one company, the D Company, and one platoon of B Company. But luckily we had Garhwalis. Garhwal Regiment had joined us. Their CO was the first Indian Sanders trained Lieutenant Colonel that I ever seen in my life until then. His name was Bonsley. He was from the Indian state of, I think, Baroda. Very nice chap. He didn't speak a word of Urdu or Hindi. His English was as English can be. He had studied here in public schools and then went to Sandhurst. And the British troops, I heard, had called him the Englishman browned off. You were dark of skin, you see. So we sat there on the 15th of February, it was, and dejected. Our CO went off to the div headquarters, and he was told that there's going to be surrender at 5 o'clock. And he should convey the thing to the British officers and be ready. So as our CO came back, very tearfully, tears running down his cheeks, Phil Parker told us. He was an Australian, incidentally. British officer, but Australian. And he spoke with a rare, rare Australian accent. And I remember his words. He said, well, the fate is that is going to be us is absolutely bloody. We will surrender today, and God knows what will happen. And then we decided that he should tell the Subedar Major, the senior most Viceroy commissioned officer. We had the Subedar Major, an honorary captain, Feroz Khan, a tower of strength, great chap. He had fought in the First World War from 1914 onwards. He was recruited in 1912, and he was with the battalion taken prisoners of war in Kotalamara in Mesopotamia. So CO called him and told him. He shook his head, pulled himself to his height of 6'2", and said, ha, I've been in it before, as a young NCO in 1817 in Kotalamara. So we quietly went about our things, and he said, don't tell the men anything yet. By 5 o'clock we were told, fight on again. The talks had broken down between General Percival and Yamashita, the Japanese commander. Captain Durrani from my battalion, he suddenly got to, as if somebody had been stung by a bee. He ran up and called the mortar platoon commander, fire with all the bloody mortars we have. Few Japanese were lurking in front of us outside the forest, and he let them have it. God knows how many of them are killed. And then, by about dark, 7, 8 o'clock, we were told cease all firing. So we ceased firing. Orders came. He said, collect all your weapons tomorrow morning, dump them in a very orderly fashion, company by company. Company by company, pile up our arms. So, and simultaneously orders came that officers and men will be dressed properly in the cleanest possible uniforms. They'll shave. They will have haircuts if possible, not to give the impression of a bedraggled, defeated rebel.